nena, soy negra, apréndetelo, no te equivoques conmigo. Recuérdalo, oye, racista, ignorante, asúmelo, vas a tener que aguantarme.
Esta negra soy yo.
You know, in the period that we're in, what are some of the skills that you want your children to learn, or what are some of the skills that you want to learn? And I actually find that if we're, you know, as we move the conversation into mental health, that planning and utilizing your family and being able to successfully delegate is a really important fact or part of really feeling like a little bit more comfort. Like one of the things for me was like, goodness, if one of us gets sick, what are the other ones going to do, right? And so being able to teach your children how to make themselves small meals or something to that effect, you know, it lets us know that if something happens, that they can take care of themselves in the most basic ways and that they have the skills to be able to manage, which I think is really important in this time. Last week, I was like, Sen, you making dinner? And he's like, no, I don't want to make dinner. I was like, no, you making dinner. So he ended up making lasagna. And it was actually pretty tasty. It was a turkey with spinach lasagna. And it was like the first time that he made it. And we had all of the fixings and he was able to really make it. And, you know, he was resistant the entire time. But I think once it was done, I think he surprised himself with how well it tastes and how he could really do it. I'm doing a workshop tomorrow about self-care. And so I've been doing some research. And they're like 8 elements or so that people are often talking about, including like financial and emotional and mental, physical. And so those are some of the things that have been coming up in terms of, and they all contribute to like your overall mental health wellness throughout challenging periods like this one.
You know, I think, Evelyn, you said something that really hit on the head for me was around how it works within a family, which I haven't considered here because I don't have that family structure here outside of my immediate family. Growing up, I didn't really think about mental health, and I'm not sure if my parents thought about mental health, right? I'm not sure if my mom always exercised, right? My mom almost always exercised and she stretched. I'm not sure if she meditated. I should ask her, but she always did yoga. And we used to call her piernas de Pilates. Like if you tell my mom that, she would laugh. She'd be like, but I remember that she got really sick. I can't remember what, but I was probably like, maybe like 8 or 9. And I remember I gave her an enema. I was really small. And she got it through it.
You can't just drop that shit like that. Yeah. Shit. No pun intended. You can't just drop that. Like it was.
It was like I had to like put like a bottle in it, right?
Yes, we know what an enema is, but you gave an enema to your mom as a child. So how old were you?
Like 8 or I think it was like I was young. I was like 8 or 9 or 10. I wasn't more than 10.
That's very
bad. But I don't think it was even like that big of a deal because there was, I feel like children were more involved in caretaking and what it means to take care of a family as well. So there is more roles. Now, keep in mind, you know, I don't know, Evelyn, when you used to visit and Dash, when you used to visit, if you saw your peer cousins washing clothes and doing all that kind of stuff that you would probably have, like do at a laundromat, like stuff that you would do here that were more machine-based just because the life is different here. But I grew up doing a lot of those things back home. And that was just part of being part of a family.
Yeah.
Right? Back home. And that, I think, created more of a, maybe for my parents, that created more of like mental ease, almost. Like, I'm trying to think.
Because you had those skills, so they didn't have to worry too much about you. Is that what you...
I don't know if it's not have to worry too much about me, or maybe it is, like...
You were self-sufficient.
Yeah, I don't know if they were teaching me these things or we were just learning it because we're growing up in this type of environment that children these days are not growing up in.
Uh-huh.
Right? So Zen, for example, making a full lasagna at his age would probably happen earlier in a different context. It was when you mentioned about the parents, when you asked the parents, what type of skills would you want your children to have? now, I'm just wondering, I've never asked myself that now, and I wonder if my parents ever asked themselves that there then, or if it was just a given, because we grew up with it, with, you know, we had a backyard, my grandmother had a backyard, my aunt had a backyard, like, people just had backyards, even if you were growing up in like a in like a really like a tin house, you had a little patio. Mm-hmm. And in that little patio, you were growing food, and you probably had two or three chickens.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, and those two or three little chickens were probably like a 3 or 4 year old's responsibility.
Yeah. I was thinking about that today, how I knew how to clean chicken and cook, you know, in middle school and before that, because I was tasked with these things because it kept the household moving, like John B. King, it kept the household moving. So yeah, I needed to learn how to clean a chicken and season it and marinate it and all of that before I even got to middle school. It was a normal thing. Because this idea of like making a perfect pot of rice on the stove and frying an egg, I've come to find through social media that that's a skill. And to me, that was basics. Like, that was the basic thing you needed to know. Like how John Bia was like, if anything, your kids can fry an egg. If there's nothing else to eat, they can fry an egg. Yeah. And either of them are even 10 years old. And I'm like, yeah, that was my context too. You knew how to make a little something for yourself. You didn't have to be 18. You know, I was washing my own clothes. All of this.
That's
all of
the these thing. Clothes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was normal. And it was me, my brother, and sister. My brother cooked up a storm. You know, it wasn't even a thing. Oh, no, well, you're the boy. No. All of you need to learn how to cook, because these are basic life skills that you're going to need in your life.
I'm trying to like figure out, like, I can't remember if I was taught it, like John Biev, like how I teach Anna Yancey.
Yeah.
And Anna Yancey in a different context wouldn't be celebrated as she is. If she were living in a rural community in Panama, she would not be celebrated as she is. Mm-hmm. Because that would be an expectation of maybe an 8-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Not necessarily of a 9-year-old boy, but yeah. It would be an expectation of an 8-year-old girl. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying she would not be celebrated. You know, she's celebrated like that because she's growing up in the United States. I'm very clear about that.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to figure out if I was ever taught to cook. And I don't think I was ever taught per se. Mm-hmm. Like, come and let me show you how to do this. And yeah. I don't know how that transfer happened. I think it was just like, I had said huevo, abrelo así, pero I don't think it was like, okay, hoy te voy a enseñar a hacer esto,
yeah.
You know.
Or I think like, there were certain tweaks, you know, if you did it and you messed up, they're like, wait, hold on. No, you have to do it like this, you know, but because we were around.
Correct.
Around them doing yeah. it, so we picked up on it. And then the day that they're like, okay, clean the chicken, you're like, okay, I know what to do because I saw you do it a few times and it's not that, you know, it's part of life, it's part of this village, it's part of the house.
And the relationships that we have, I think, are a little bit different, or that we had were a little bit different. So for example, when there was company, like, I wasn't always excluded from the conversation. I was discouraged from joining the conversation, but I was not excluded. Yes. From being right in, like, from being in the environment, in the immediate environment. So you also got to learn by watching things, and then you kind of waited, and it was an exciting thing to wait to be your turn to be asked to do certain things. So I feel like there was a source of almost like necessity, but also it was you did it well because that was a recognition of your growth, right?
Yeah, right of passage.
The pride, right, in terms of being asked to do certain things. Whereas I feel like even the option of being asked to do something, right? And while I recognize it and I utilize it as a parent, I also recognize that makes the skill acquisition different.
Yes.
Yes. Right? And that I think for myself, like, that's something that I do question. It's a source of being humbled all the time, right? Being a parent. Like, you think one thing and then all of a sudden your children just like, ha! Laugh in your face, right? Literally and figuratively. I recognize that there has to be an intentionality with what you teach your children when your options are so much broader than your parents. And so what are some non-negotiables in terms of like culture and experience? Do you want your children, or do you need them to really pass on and what that can do for you as we talk about this conversation and we think about like my mental space, like there's a sense of like grief and guilt when your child doesn't know what you know about your culture. Right. And it hurts, I think, lots of people. And there are lots of people who don't hurt because I think that their desire to assimilate into U.S. culture was so thorough that they actively didn't, you know, they intentionally also chose the opposite. Yeah. But I also feel like but then you're left with like very little. Right. And I feel like over time, like there's a moment to be able to still pivot and be able to say, like, what are some elements of my own culture that really matter to me? And that I think are so important, and how do I successfully, now I have to teach it because it's not done by proximity. It's like, I have to actually sit down, and there are rules to this, right?
You have to be intentional, like you said.
Right, like when I was telling Sonari to season the turkey, and I was just like, he was like, how much seasoning? And I was like, bitch, just season until the ancestors tell you to stop right now, and then add some more. Like, and he's looking at me like, ancestors?
But to your point, what we were talking about earlier about raising free kids, and you want to raise free kids, but what happens when the free kids that you're raising backfires on you, and you're like, wait a second now, you know, you talking back? You know, how free do we want you to be?
They too free, right? Well, you know, like what is the right amount of free, right?
And what is free? What is free?
So again, that requires that intentionality of like, what is free, right? Because this, I'm gonna just go ahead and say it, that there are some free kids that are assholes, and it is not about freedom. It is actually about you kid being an asshole. I know people whose children I don't like, right? And it bothers me because I'm also very open with kids, like I'm encouraging, right, of full expression. So it's like it frustrates me to think that
it's more discipline rather than freedom is what we're talking
There's
about.
A free child right now in the Bronx. He's probably like 17, and all he does since this coronavirus started is bounce his fucking basketball all night long outside my house because he's a free child, and I guess that's how he works out his anxiety. Right outside of my house is bouncing the fucking ball all fucking night.
That's his freedom, freedom ball.
The freedom ball. And I'm like,
is that free or, but that's to me, it's like, does freedom require recognition of your surroundings, right? Because to me, that's not freedom. That's like you just being a thoughtless asshole. Like people have to live across where. So I don't know that I would define that as free.
No, I'm being funny. I'm being funny because I'm annoyed. And he's already outside bouncing the ball.
Oh, then fuck his ass.
Every time I go back home, I notice a difference in parenting. Without judgment, right? And I know that I feel some judgment from my folks towards me because they think I am raising them as white kids, raising my kids as white kids.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't spank and, you know, Omar and I don't spank and we have these constant conversations. And I've been told that we speak too much to the kids. And that if we gave them 2 correazos, which is 2 spankings, this would be all over. You know, but then I had my niece once tell me that she wished that her parents would speak more and hit less, and you know that stuck with me. And I haven't been able, and I'm not gonna have that conversation with my cousins just because you know I've been told that I'm raising white kids. So why am I gonna? Like, I'm not going to even engage in that conversation because then I leave and, you know, the white girl leaves. But then I'm always left wondering their interpretation of freedom, quote unquote, is not spanking. And that's it. And not thinking of the repercussions that spanking could create.
Everything that comes with it.
And everything that comes with it. And they're really convinced that my kids are going to turn out into assholes, right? Without discipline, that are going to turn against Omar and I and are going to fully run this household. And sometimes I feel like this. Sometimes I actually feel that the kids are turning into these little inflatable monsters.
Inflatable though?
Yeah, you know via Argentina at the end of the street how they have that man that sells the inflatable dolls like that. I feel like sometimes you wear an Yancy or like growing into these things and they're taking over the house. And then they get deflated really fast. But I feel like sometimes I'm like, you know, especially the other day he ran, I was like, wait. Like he said, espérate. And I was like, oh no, 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 no. You don't tell me espérate when I'm, and then I was like, what's wrong with him telling me espérate? But I was like, no, because if he tells me espérate now, then it's like the next thing is like cállate. He didn't say that. No, he said espérate.
No, I'm saying that the way that your mind operates, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's such a fascinating thing that you're projecting all of this stuff because it's in you that you're recognizing that you're in the intersection of like present and future, a present and past and present, right? Present, whatever.
I'm like, you don't say espérate. I'm like, no, 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 no. Tú no me dices a mí que me espere. You do it right now.
And if you were in Guatemala, it would be not that he said espérate, that he didn't say espérese.
Oh.
Language, right? Because when you are from usted culture,
yes,
I could never tell my mom to. She'd be like, a mí no me tuteas.
Uh-huh.
Yo soy usted. So immediately my brain went to, instead of espérate, it went to, it's not espérese?
Yeah, in Panama, it's very, uno se tutea mucho en Panama. Yeah. But when I've gone other places, it's very usted culture.
Yeah, right? Usted for us. So it's like the hierarchy plays itself out in the language.
It's so Panama is still very tú.
Yeah,
and when I travel, it's very usted. In Colombia, the kids had a hard time because it's very usted, and then they got used to it. They got used to it like this, but I didn't. Okay, I'm so ingrained with the tú.
I make it a habit to do the usted with Black people in Latin America, like
outside of Panama.
Well, no, even in Panama, like wherever I go, when I refer to my husband, I use the usted form when we're in in public.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm. When we're around people, I do it when there's other people around to be like, yeah, this is a person that I'm giving respect to, you know, because they're not usually seeing that the Blacks aren't getting the respect. And of course, again, it's working within the white gaze, and you know what I'm saying. But I think we can do both at once.
Wait a minute. So you're modeling for other people what they should call him, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
So you want them to also tell him usted?
Yeah.
So you say usted so that you'd be like, I tell him usted, you say usted as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for Black people in general, because the general habit when we're talking about Black people in Latin America is mi negro. That's always the default. And it's like, you don't even know him, sir. You don't know him. Why are you calling him me anything? You don't know him. And so, yeah, like you said, it's modeling. No, this is how you're going to refer to him. Period.
Period.
Period. No, but what you asked us this morning, you're like, how are you feeling?
Yes.
And I just always wake up with a knot in my stomach.
And I wake up with a chest pain. And I don't know if it's like, and I look it up every morning. I'm like, what is this? Because not on my left side. It's on my right side, which could mean like a gastric thing, could mean heartburn. I do eat a lot of salt and vinegar chips at night.
Ooh, that's my favorite.
With turmeric, I put turmeric on it.
That's my salt and vinegar.
Why? What?
Well, turmeric is good anti-inflammatory, and I figure if I'm eating so much potato chips, I should at least bring down the inflammation.
Cancel each other out?
Okay.
No, but I've been having like iterations of like death and dying and making peace with it. Because I can't see, you know, I feel trapped. I feel like I can't see my way out of this. And what is it going to be? What is out of this and what is after this?
Yeah.
You know, uncertainty is what always gets me. Just in life in general, the uncertainty is what will drive me insane. And I need to learn how to manage that, because it's impractical, because a lot of things in life are uncertain.
Yeah. And so, I've been trying to focus. I was on a call today with a colleague, with Anna, with a colleague of mine. And we were trying to, like, you know, a lot of organizing is focused on right now, what's going to happen right now. And we're trying to, like, focus on, like, what's going to happen after this, right? Like, how do we start mobilizing for what's going to happen after? Because what's going to happen after, I feel it's going to be worse than what's happening right now.
Mm.
So it's also, like, how do we, like, use our imagination to, like, envision what could happen, you know, moving forward beyond this. So, like, you know, trying to look at, like, March of 2021, April to 2021, and seeing what could be there. And I just don't know. It's just really hard, you know? So,
yeah.
Yeah, I worry about my parents. You know, I worry about my parents. They're taking it more seriously now.
Good.
I lose sleep over them. I lose sleep over my children, but not about their health. I'm not worried about their health at all. They're super duper healthy. I worry about what world they're going to be in and if I'm going to be in it. Mm. I worry if their grandmother is going to be in it, not my mother. I think my mother is going to be in it. I worry if my father is going to be in it. And I worry if Omar's mom is going to be in it.
Mm.
I also, you know, so there's these, I don't know where in the world I'm going to be. And then I find this, like, for me, what's helping me is knowing that I'm not going down alone, as sad as that sounds.
I agree with you.
I feel like we're all going through it. I feel like we're all in this sinking boat.
Yeah.
And even saying that is, like, really heavy on me. And then I feel like I have to keep the integrity of who I am, mm-hmm. and not lose sight of who I really am. And
yeah.
And I've always been a person that mobilizes for other people. And I'm not going to stop doing that, right? So as long as I can still breathe, I'm still going to mobilize for other people. It doesn't mean I'm not going to take care of myself. But as long as I can breathe, I'm going to mobilize for people that... Because in the order of things, I am very privileged, right? I have my oppressions and I have all that stuff. I'm fucked in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a lot of privileges.
Yeah.
I have a lot more privileges than a lot of other people. So as long as I have those privileges, I'm going to mobilize for those. You know, my heart has always been with people that are impacted by incarceration, because I've had family members impacted by incarceration. You know, I've been impacted by incarceration. So my energy has always been there. I'm an abolitionist, so... You know, so I'm always going to mobilize towards, especially children in cages and all, you know, all that stuff. So I'm always going to remain true to that.
Yeah. My biggest thing lately has been the financial, because the pandemic has obliterated my business. I basically have no job, and I don't know how I'm going to, honestly, I don't know how I'm going to pay rent. And so I guess that's why I wake up with my stomach in knots, because I'm not only responsible for myself, I also have family and family members that depend on us. And so at this point I'm looking for other jobs, and that is very scary and frightening, because there's bills that have to be paid, and I depend on no one except myself. And so that's been the point of contention for me, is that just the financial aspect, the income, and how to manage that, you know, because I don't have a safety net in that regard. I mean, the stimulus check, okay, that's helpful in theory. But again, that moving past a month from now, what is that going to look like? And, you know, and the thing is that I am worried, but I also have faith,
yeah.
You know, because I've been in worse situations, financially rather. and I've always made it through. But again, it's always like, it's, you know, it's always this survival mode that is very exhausting.
Yeah.
And especially in this environment, because the survival mode when there's abundance is very different than survival mode when there's scarcity all around us. And that's what we're seeing a lot of. And so that's been my biggest thing as of late.
And that time, which has historically been used as a, ten paciencia, mija, as a source of comfort, is an enemy right now.
Yeah.
Like if you're thinking that you have bills, like if you manage to scrape up your April rent, every day is like getting closer to the next.
No, actually March rent, March and April.
So it's like, so thinking about the fact that time, which has historically been used as like a bomb, right, is yeah. not utilized as a bomb right now. It is actually offensive, and that more, you know, like the data that we're listening to, oh, we're 8 days from the peak, or X amount of people per day are perishing from this, or don't do that, or we don't know. So it's like the uncertainty and then time not being able to be certain. Right, time doesn't give us any type of solace in this case, so it just adds to that fear. But I think I agree with what you both are saying. Like, I definitely am afraid. I am fearful for like my mom. I'm fearful for myself. I find myself in like circles of regret of things that I haven't accomplished or that I haven't done yet, and that also is time, right? Like, feeling like I've wasted time, or that I haven't done enough with my time, or that I misuse the time that I have been allocated, right? Mm-hmm. And then thinking about like when you're looking at people that are similar age, right, that are like just seemingly fine, and all of a sudden it seems like the time is making the box tighter, like the circles of people that start to like pass away are closer and closer and closer. Mm-hmm. And that also feels very scary. So like even 3 weeks ago, it was like, oh, I heard that there was somebody. A week ago, it was like somebody. Now it's just like, please. So
just now it's like your neighbor, your friends,
right?
Your sister's teacher.
Yes, like it's like people that I know. Like,
yeah.
So that part I think has also been really, it's been a lot for me. And I think that it also hurts to think that, to see, I mean, you always see politics and politicians and just from every level, right? Like from every circle, it feels like just more disdain and oppression. So it's like my internalized stuff that I'm trying to kind of successfully work through and unsuccessfully most days. But then it's like, it doesn't feel better here. It doesn't feel better there. It doesn't feel better there. It's just like, I'm exhausted. And maybe a lot of other people are. And we clearly the three of us are.
Yeah.
And so. I find
what helps is what we're doing now, talking to my loved ones.
Yeah. Same. It's helpful. And so maybe there are some people out there that also are finding some support. So definitely share with us like what you're feeling. Because also, if depending on what you're, even the privilege of having friends is a privilege, right? Of keeping friends is a skill, like we talked about before. Of having the opportunity to be able to have, like one of the things that I'm thinking about is just how many choices have to be made, right? Like just the privilege of space, physical and emotional space is huge right now, right? Where we're able to successfully vent with one another, right? Like having this exchange is a privilege, and also being able to support other people and being able to have listening ears. So definitely write us, I think, at Radio Caña Negra. You know, we'll respond back. I certainly can commit to at least sitting with that with you in the event that you want to share what some of your challenges are. You don't want to say them out loud. Yeah. We talked about having a cry along on Zoom a little while ago. So I'm like,
yeah, we need to have that.
We need to have a cry along. What do you think?
Desahogo.
Huh?
Un desahogo.
Sí, un desahogo. That would be nice.
I know. I think, yeah, folks just need, yeah. I need to cry.
We need an outlet. We're trapped. I feel trapped.
Yeah.
It's hard to see beyond this. And I was saying to one of my friends that, like what Jean-Via pointed out, that we're all together. on this sinking ship. You know, obviously some other people have boats that are sinking faster, but it's all contingent on all of these countries working and doing their due diligence to flatten the curve, as we continue saying.
Really?
Because if we have zero cases, let's say Corona, in my case, let's say Corona disappears in Panama, we have zero cases, right? It's still contingent on other countries also working to get those cases down, or to find a way to maintain it in a way that the healthcare system isn't overwhelmed and, you know, et cetera, because it's highly contagious. And so it's all of the nations, all of the countries, all the communities that that would have to get to where we're at a safe space in terms of the level of transmission. And that's what
the governmental priorities, the thing is, we're in this for a long time because the governmental priorities for countries are just not there. As long as different countries, including Panama and Colombia, are supporting an invasion in Venezuela, nobody's flattening no curve.
That's what I mean. that it's contingent on other factors outside of, even within our insular communities.
And as long as animals are getting tests before human beings, because right now, since tigers are getting it, you know the Humane Society is going to be giving tests to cats before they give it to human beings. It's prescription. What happened in New Orleans around animals being saved over human beings, this is what's going to happen right now.
Yeah.
So it's coming. The fact that one little tiger got a confirmed COVID-19 test, that means that tiger got at least 30 tests done. So that was confirmed.
You know, it's one of those things, like, you know, we read all the time, like, when things happen, Black people get it worse, right? But this is yet just one more thing that it's like, a few weeks ago, there was the joke that Black people just weren't really being affected physically by Corona. And now it just feels like everybody that's being affected by Corona is Black. Like, from every level. If you alive, you broken alive. Like, there's no escape.
The healing part is the big question. I mean, for me, I'm turning more and more to my muertos. I find that my altar looks amazing. Like, I'm giving special attention to my altar and talking to my muertos even more now, because it's not much that is within my power. And so I think in these times people cling more to their spirituality. And in my case, my oricha is, you know, we talk about death. Like, I've been sitting with those feelings for about 2 weeks plus, and I don't know, I don't want to say I find comfort, because that's the wrong word, but it is giving me a sense of stability that I'm not finding in the current environment that we're in. It is a certain level of certainty, you know, your egun or your muertos, that they are in their state. And so that's what's giving me a little bit of stability in these times. And then, as I said, like, turning to my friends and family, speaking to them. I don't let a day go by without actually, you know, FaceTiming or videoing with a family or a friend. Like, because otherwise, like, I don't even know.
Headspace is free if you live in the tri-state. If you're into meditation.
Yeah, it'll be, you know, send us an email as well as to resources that you might have. RayoCañaNegra@gmail.com. You know, I was just reading an article around custody and new challenges that this is bringing up for regards to children, because of parents.
I mean, my own son has not seen his dad in some time because of this, like, and that's really difficult, right? Like, the navigation. And I mean, I'm grateful that my son is a little bit older, but like, when he was smaller and like I needed the time more, maybe, you know, he's a lot more independent now, but definitely I think about that in terms of single parents that have multiple kids and how they sometimes look forward to this time, A, for their children to connect with their other parent, but also B, to have a little bit of time to be able to do things, clean the house, like sleep, right? And so all of a sudden to not have this support and through no fault of anybody's, right? It's just somebody's going to have to lose, right? There's a really great article in Level magazine, the Medium magazine for men, of a father who talks about like the custodial piece and what that feels like and sounds like, and also just missing important days like birthdays, you know, potentially like all the, I mean, when you think about all the loss, right, beyond just the physical privilege that we have of, you know, potentially being safe, hopefully, and staying that way, is the loss. Like there are graduating classes that are not gonna have graduating events that, yeah. And that's a hurtful thing for them, you know, class of 2020 in all levels, even whether it's that, you know, you wanted your child to wear a cap and gown in pre-K, like you lose out on that. And that's very hurtful.
Yeah. I don't know when's the next time I'm going to see my long distance husband. And he asked me, he's like, when do you think you can come to Cuba? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
The airports are closed. The last time I saw him was in February. And so I'm like, maybe in June we can hope for that. But yeah, I'm quarantining alone. My family lives like 45 minutes away. And I can't even go 45 minutes to be with them or see them. And also my grandmother is almost 80 years old. I'm not going to do it even if I could.
Yeah.
So dealing with that, it's scary, you know, and then trying to kind of gauge his movements too, because he wasn't taking this serious until like maybe yesterday, because he thought the hood was going to protect him. There wasn't a lot of cases in his hood in Havana until like maybe yesterday. And he was out and about until the cases, you know, then they found out about the cases and he's scared now. I'm like, you should have been scared a month ago, you know, but of course people are going to do, you know, we're all adults. People are going to do what they're going to do. And the most I can do is again, warn you like I did with my grandmother. I'm like, stay your ass in the house. And she is great, you know, great. But also my husband, he loves the street. He loves hanging out in the street, you know? And now he's confined to the house. And of course, the confinement to the house, he can't go out and make money. And again, you know, and so it's being compounded, you know, this and that, the layers upon it.
They call it like a circle of control, right? Or like your circle of influence versus your circle of power and your circle of control. Like identifying what are some things that are within that circle of control are really important.
Correct. My passion is children's books. My passion is writing. Like, that's what it is. So I also leaned into that after seeing him and how much joy it brought him and all that kind of stuff. And I started doing the children's books, and that has brought me an immense amount of joy, and it's bringing a lot of joy to a lot of people, but it's also making me write more, right? So that's also my mental health piece, is I'm leaning more into what's bringing me joy, even though it's not bringing me money.
And that the things that bring you joy, right, tend to bring you money at some point. Like
at some point,
that's the other side too. Like I think that when you utilize your talents, like what is it, your gifts will make room for you.
Correct. Right. But we can't go into it like that. I don't feel like we can go into it like that, because then it's, for me, then it's not authentic for me.
Why?
I don't know, because then it's like forcing, for me, then it's forcing something. I've been looking for a publisher forever, like for years, like 8 years, I've been looking for a publisher and I haven't gotten it. And I know I'm a good writer, but I also know that 1% of the writing industry is Black authors. Mm-hmm. I also know, I've been told multiple times that Black Latina writing, has to be fictional, and most of my writing is not fictional. And that if it were, yeah, that's Afro-Latina writing, right? That non-fictional writing would fall under African-American writing, and I don't write African-American history. So it's like this thing, because I also write very bilingual. So, and it doesn't fall under Latino writing. I've been through this for years.
No, so I think it's interesting what Evelyn was, the what she was asking you in that when you said you don't want to go into it with the idea of making money, then it's inauthentic. Did I read that right?
Yeah,
that's what I said.
Yeah, Jumpia.
No, that was my question.
I found it interesting what Evelyn was driving at. That why not? Why can't you make money off of your joy?
I feel like if you can, great. But that shouldn't be the determining factor. And I'm saying for me, I've been trying to make money off of it for years, and that has had me stuck because self-publishing is very expensive. And between paying for the basic things that I have to pay and publishing my own book, like, I have to pay for my basic things.
Yeah.
Even though I know that the book is going to bring a lot of money. One of my suggestions for folks is really to lean into what brings you joy and share it. And share it with the world, because if it brings you happiness and joy, then it's, like, powerful, right? Yeah. Like, you know? Like, I feel like maybe, like, Zumba for you, Evelyn, that you do. Dash, I saw you really happy today on the live that you did.
Well, I started my daily dash of diaspora series on Instagram. So you're right. I've been wanting to do that for a long time. And so I've been able to create a little bit more.
Yeah. And then the other piece, and this is linked to Evelyn's point. You know, our relationship to money has to change a little bit.
Because a lot,
right? People out there are charging for stuff, and I don't want to be charging for things.
But I don't change that. Like, I think we can learn a little bit from that. A little bit.
People are charging. The other day, a friend of mine was like, oh, you should sign up on IATI for this art class. And then I went and looked, and it's $10 for this art class. And I was like, and people are paying. And then I was like, I'm not paying for an art class. And then she was like, oh, it's too late. It's sold out. Mm-hmm. And people are paying $10 a class. Well, and I was like, what do you mean people are...
And $10 a class is actually nothing. I think that's a really good point that you're making, Jean-Pierre, because I feel like I consider that to be like the millennial upsell, right? Like, I think that there is a comfort with charging and selling for things that millennials have that people that are our age were not raised that way. It was like, you use your, you know, you throw your talent and then it's like, we'll see. But I feel like there's a space, because I think that when I talk to like many of the younger women that I talk to, they're always like, well, how much is that going to be? Like, and I'm like, you don't even have that many skills. Like, how is it? But I think that there is a space. Like, that's my thing. In fact, I talk about it with Chris very often. And I think that there's an energy exchange that can happen in terms of generation that it's like, at least for me, I can't speak for you, but I think that when I was growing up, it was like, you always had to prove that you knew how to do something before, right? Before you got compensated.
You had to pay your dues.
You had to pay dues, literally and figuratively, right? You had to pay dues, so you had to prove some sort of expertise. I think that younger people are like coming in with, I'm just doing, pay me or pay me for nothing. Like, there's lots of people that are just like, oh, I'm gonna give you information that I read in a book. Here's my Cash App, my Venmo, my PayPal, my Zelle, and you deserve because of my thoughts. My thoughts are so amazing that they deserve for you to give me money. That left us having both sides have really unhealthy relationships with money.
Yeah.
And particularly, I think that, so when you're adding in the generational piece, in addition to adding in the work piece, that I think that work, like the work that we do has historically been underpaid or not even considered to be real work. Yeah. And so that also adds to the challenges that we may have, the dynamic that we have and how money plays itself out.
And what we feel we have a right to charge for.
Right. Right.
Because other people feel that they have a right to pay us or to lowball us, rather.
Right. So it's like, so that is, I think that that's a really big thing. And hopefully like in an upcoming episodes, y'all want to hear us talk about money? Because I think that's a really important thing. And as we come out.
Money.
Yeah.
Right? Here, so we've got to insert Cardi B right here. Money. right? But just really thinking about how to successfully, like, I think one of the things that has to come out of this is just a real acknowledgement that the way that we have been handling money to date, that ish ain't working. And that it hasn't worked. It ain't gonna work, right? Mm-hmm. It hasn't served us. Yeah. And that we need to do better. We need to do different at minimum. Maybe not better, but different.
And owning our intellectual property, because so much of our intellectual property has been stolen and profited off of, and we're completely erased out of the equation. And then later on, we complain. And so I think there is value into going into something with the intention of making money. These bills got to get paid, you know, and that's just basic survival. It's not even, and I don't think many of us even go into it with the idea, oh, I'm going to get rich. I'm going to get wealthy. You know, literally, can I pay my rent consistently without having a panic attack at the end of the month? Like, just that. Like, can I have my basic necessities covered without sweating every single week on end? Can we at least give ourselves that luxury?
Yeah. And what do I need to do or learn? What skills do I need to develop in order to comfortably position myself to be able to do that, right? Because I think that there's also this space of, like, some of the people that I know that do childcare, they charge like $60 an hour, and people will pay it without even batting an eyelash.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they'll just be like, this is what you charge.
Yeah.
Carry on.
That's your price. So, you pay your price.
That's your price, right? You found your audience. And I think that that's, it's important for us to really have those, like, deep dives into the conversation and the beliefs that we have about money and how to keep it, how to get more of it without feeling like you're selling yourself or that, because I feel like that's the other side too, right? That there's been this historic suggestion that people who make money have sold some part of their soul in order to be able to, they're evil, right? Like, and that's not true. Either. Definitely. This has given us a lot of food for thought. Write us and tell us what's coming up for you at RadioCañaNegra@gmail.com or follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Check us out for our stories, our historic stories. Check out Dash at Diaspora Dash, Genevieve at Afro Resistance, and me at Ripeness.